Okay, so this evening is a bit different. I'm not going to give the talk. Ajahn Khrundam is not going to give the talk. Ajahn Jyoti Paul is not going to give the talk. Ajahn Yanipo is not going to give the talk. It's the tradition from Ajahn Chah, the time of Ajahn Chah, and all that. This is called Pawarna, the last day of the traditional rains retreat, and you would ask the junior members of the community to give some Dhamma reflections to other members of the community, so that from Tankasapo down to Beth. And we'll have the names in the names out of the bells, and somebody will give some reflections. And what we can do is wait until the last person, and then, say, rather than giving the animal after each talk, then wait till all the talks have been done. People will give reflections, something or other, and we'll say in a monastery like Wat Pa Pong or even Wat Nam Cha, we've got to tell Wat Pa Pong 30, 40, 50 monks, and it goes all night. Tonight probably won't go all night. It'll go for a little while. Get to hear different people's perspectives in the first person. Hi, that's funny. First one was Samanera Jokaro. He's sick tonight. Because, I don't know how he's been sort of all vomiting. So he packed it in early.
Could go up and get him.
It's going faster than you thought it would.
So there. And so the first person is actually Tenkacha.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang saranang, Buddhang dhammang saranang, Sanghang namasami. I think I went first last year too. But I have enough faith in randomness not to think there's anything particularly strange about that. So part of the vasa at Abhayagiri is that each community member gets a solitary retreat for 2 weeks, and we rotate. So in any given period during Vasa, which is roughly July through October, about one-fifth of the community, one-quarter, will be basically just living on their own in their kuti. And, they don't have any responsibilities with the community. If they want food, they can come down for the meal. And, yeah, this is a... We live in a great place for solitary retreat. When you're alone at your kuti, or some monks even choose to go out on a platform in the forest, you're really alone. And this is the... And so you really have the opportunity to schedule, to figure out what works for your own practice without any constraints. And that's a very valuable thing to know, because it's useful to be able to practice within structures and be able to use structures, but you also gain a great sense of self-confidence when you know where there are no structures. I can still settle my mind and make progress towards a goal that's totally internal and totally on my own. And so you said, okay. I mean, we all need the support of community from at various points in our practice, but solitary practice has its fruits as well. And so we get to choose, or actually not really choose, we get sent out there. You're going to have to live at your kuti alone whether you like it or not. And so that's the practice. And just as a side note, I think it's actually very helpful for the rest of the community to learn how to function when four of its members aren't there. Because it teaches us things like patience and flexibility, and it helps ensure that all of us know how to cover each other's responsibilities well enough so that when someone goes somewhere else, the monastery doesn't fall apart. So that's a additional benefit to the community that we don't necessarily notice. For myself, one of the things that I've found useful the past 3 years is to choose a particular, retreats for lay people are typically 10 days is about very standard. And so to choose a 10-day retreat given by, the last 3 years it's been Ajahn Suchito, and listen to the talks and guided meditations for that retreat in order, day in, day out, not necessarily every day, but just whenever it seems appropriate. And each year I've found this very helpful for a number of reasons. It gives one themes to reflect on, and the structure of the 10-day, and you follow the structure of the 10-day retreat. So in the beginning, Ajahn Suchito, or whoever you're chosen, is explaining how to begin the retreat. And in the middle, he's teaching people who have a calm mind, just like yours maybe is. And then at the end, it's instructions on, okay, now you're going back to something other than retreat. How do you deal with that? And so that's in a sense, it gives you some structure, and this is also something. Yeah, even if you're a layperson, and the retreat you want to go on is at the wrong time for your busy schedule, especially if you've had some experience before, this might actually be a very good idea. Just pick a retreat and just go with the audio recordings. And I guess for tonight, in particular, the one of the aspects that Ajahn Suchecho talked about was just the opportunities that arise in ending a retreat. Because there's, yeah, I mean, if you don't, you know, you can either be dreading the end or longing for it, but if you don't follow what, you know, if you consciously don't follow your inclinations, and man, to either hang on to the very last bit of retreat that you can get, or just as soon as you can find an excuse not to be on retreat, to just abandon it completely, then there's a lot of wisdom that one can learn. Yeah, I think there's a term called repatriated anthropology, which is when the anthropologist has gone out and lived in the bush for years, and you know he or she has done his research, done research on whichever, you know, African or Amazonian tribe they're researching, and you know the way that some anthropology works is you try to live that, you try to learn the skills that they do, you try to think the way that they do, and you know, and you, yeah, that's a pretty deep learning compared to just, you know, taking pictures and talking to people. But then they can do something else. They go back, and suddenly Western culture, where they came from, is really weird. And they see it with a perspective that none of us have, because we haven't lived 5 years in the bush. And you can do that very same thing with retreat, because the life that you were used to before retreat is now strange. And so you can see things that you didn't see before. And one example that just happened for me quite, just a couple of hours ago, it was just before our Pawarana chanting ceremony, and a couple of, I know, I guess a conversation started between, it was just before the ceremony, Lumpur Pasano was chanting his confession to one of the monks. It's just, formulaic. We all confess offenses to each other every 2 weeks. So he was chanting, and two senior monks started talking about business stuff, and then I chimed in and asked one of the senior monks a question, and then one of the other junior monks said something, and then, you know, I realized that, yeah, I had something to say to that particular junior monk, and so I started saying it, and then a fifth monk then said something like to the effect of, please don't talk while Lungpur is chanting his confession to me. Like, and then, you know, that's it. And, that's pretty typical, just to receive feedback like that. And it's really, you know, really minor feedback. But, what happened is I didn't say anything other than being quiet. But I watched and I could see, just my mind immediately went to thinking, I guess the first thing was, I really made a mistake. I made a mistake there. And then I started, and then the mind kept going. There was a bit of perhaps some sense of irritation, and then more proliferating about it. Why didn't that monk what was particularly wrong about my speech when there were three other monks who were doing the same thing. And then, you know, I ponder, you know, and then just thinking, well, you know, the monk who admonished me was senior to me, but junior to the initial talkers. So maybe he admonished me to, you know, to let us all know. And I thought, well, that's actually a good strategy. I've done that before myself. But then something, I don't know why. Well, actually, it was entirely because of the retreat that I'd been on. I mean, that's all what I'm describing right now is totally normal response for me when admonished. It's to proliferate about it. But you know, Ajahn Suchito has, during the retreat, his retreat talks, he really emphasizes the quality of heart. And he says, you know, he uses, it's a Western division. It's not, you know, it comes from Western thought rather than from the Buddha's teachings. But you know, wherever suffering ends, that's the practice. And yeah, so Ajahn Suchito describes how the heart, it doesn't actually, you know, it doesn't actually, sense impressions don't actually move the heart. It's feeling and perception. So the words don't actually get there. What gets there is, yeah, feelings, perceptions, and it doesn't feel in words. And so, and I'm very much not used to paying attention to it. But I noticed, wow, yeah, hurt. And just to, that's different for me, to notice that, and to not have to make it, because I feel hurt, to not have to either say the monk who admonished me did so wrongly, or he should have done it more skillfully, or to go into the story that, oh, there, you know, there's something really wrong with me. This hurt. And that's fine. And actually, about a minute later, the heart feeling was just gratitude. Because, yeah, to learn these things, both for the retreat teachings of Ajahn Suchito and for the admonishment by my fellow monk, not because of the topic, which, I mean, it's good. I won't do that again. And it's good to respect one's, you know, confessing monks by not talking. But even more important than the content of it was, yeah, just the recognition. Oh, yeah, this is being with the heart, and this is really important for my practice. And just further reflections on that, I think today is Pawarana Day, which as part of that, the ceremony that happened just after the situation I described, each of us in the community in Pali invited, in the language of the Buddha, invited all the other members of the community to give us feedback out of compassion for us so that we can grow in the Buddha's path. And the way that the way that I received that particular feedback was actually, I think, very helpful, because we want to stay in touch with that emotional side of things, but and not have to, not either have to sort of condemn ourselves, oh, what a horrible, whatever, what a horrible person I am, because, I'm really, if I get admonished, that means I'm really awful. Or, what right do you have to admonish me? I should admonish you instead. Just taken right from a real character in the Buddhist suttas, Venerable Chana. And neither, both of those responses are not skillful and really constrict the heart. And so being able to stay with it and opening to pain, opening to hurt, instead of clamping down, there's wisdom there. And so I will leave these thoughts for your reflection.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So, I'm not a big talker in general, and I never done this before. For some reason at Amaravati we don't do this tradition. just to Tangachana talked about Ajahn Suchito. Before I start, I just want to share my favorite Ajahn Suchito's quote. I wasn't there, I just heard that at one time, one of the community, before the winter retreat, I believe, a community member asked him, Ajahn, when the winter retreat actually begins? And he said that, well, for some, it's already begun. For some, it never will. I really like this one. As for myself, I'm contemplating a lot about on gratitude, and it's always starts with the Buddha, of course. His huge effort and great sacrifice, discovering and teaching the Dhamma. It's quite frightening to think about what my life would be without the Dhamma. And also, of course, the generation of monastics who upheld the teachings, and also the generations of lay people who supported them. The Kruba Ajans in Thailand, the forest monks who at the beginning of the 20th century kind of revived the teaching and started a great tradition. Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Mahabua, many others. And the first, and their first Western disciples, like Lompur Sumedho, Lompur Pasano, Ajahn Amaro, who brought the teaching to the West, and which actually allows, which allowed us to get in touch with the teachings, both monastics and lay people. I think many of us definitely, myself, I I couldn't go to Thailand 6 years ago to ordain, and it's a really fortunate time we living in that we can be in contact with the Dhamma in the West. And train under great teachers. It's a really fortunate thing. And these monasteries are now all over the world, so many in Europe, more and more in the States, Australia, New Zealand. Many of you knows that I'm leaving soon. A few days after the Katina. The plan is to stay a month with Ajahn Sudanto and the Pacific Hermitage, and then flying over to the East Coast to spend the next winter retreat with Ajahn Jayanto in New Hampshire. And then going back to Amaravati just before the next Pansa. So there will be quite a lot of changes in my life in a relatively short time, in 6, 7, 8 months, 4 different monasteries. Certainly the practice, pray patience and patience and what's the word? Reflexibility, I think. It helps, hopefully. It was a really wonderful and fruitful year here at Abhayagiri. I'm really grateful for this opportunity. And I'd like to thank for everybody, the monastic community, and the lay supporters. It's a great place, a wonderful community. Really good experience for me. So, thank you very much.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Bhutang dhammang sanghang namatami. All right, my time to shine. Remember coming here last week, or last year, and hearing that reflection from Ajahn Dhanaka before he gave a Dhamma talk. Like, yeah, when I first got here, I'm gonna give him the Dhamma. I'm ready for it. Let me give a talk. And now that I'm, you know, so many years into it, it's like, whew, Dhamma talk, all right. So, I don't know, I certainly felt that way in lay life. You know, where's my soapbox? Everybody needs to hear about the Four Noble Truths. I used to have this saying, everybody wants to be Bruce Wayne, nobody wants to be Batman, you know. And, there's a lot of you know, one of the things I was really kind of fed up with, and what led me to monasticism and this lifestyle, is just kind of the spiritual materialism in the world sometimes. You know, everybody wants the quick fix. You know, the me, 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 now, now, now. You know, what kind of yoga posture can I do with the special breathing technique and, you know, diet and mantra and, you know, meditation. And, you know, I did, you know, 30-day silent retreat and I'm super spiritual. You know, and it's just kind of, it was difficult to see a lot of people talk the talk but not walk the walk, you know. And, so I think that's what brought me here, to piggyback on Tan Avro. I think that, it is terrifying to think about what my life would have been like. You know, it's, if I didn't have the Dhamma, you know, and I think didn't come to this path in particular, just in that, you know, not that it was particularly bad, but maybe it wouldn't have been as wholesome as this. You know, and the good fortune that I have to train in this way, you know, and find the middle way. I reflect on that on some of the more difficult days, and that, you know, this is the holy life. This is what I always wanted, you know, and that this is a good fortune, that it's like a perfect storm to kind of come to the Dhamma and be exposed to it and be able to practice earnestly, you know, and that to really embody it, not just talk about, oh yeah, well, I meditate every day, or, you know, I do this or that, and I'm spiritual, but to really just, you know, be a good person and really train the heart and let it come out, you know, all the time, you know, really live it. Something I reflect on is, you know, on those difficult days that, well, where was I last year, and where was I going? What were some of my intentions? What I was worried about, or what I wanted to do, or what was I doing? And every single time, I think, oh yeah, I'm doing way better now. Just keep going. I think patient endurance has been something that's been ringing through as my Anagarika year of just keep doing, you know. And really something that arose that was kind of absent in the lay Dhamma that I was receiving, as fantastic as it was and passionate as made me about the Dhamma and following the path and learning the Buddhist teachings, was faith, you know. Is that was kind of like something tiptoed around, and, you know, it's kind of like, well, you know, the Buddhist teachings are very practical and logical, and, you know, it makes a lot of sense, and you don't necessarily need faith to meditate or to be a good person or to reap a lot of the benefits from what the Buddha had to say and teach. And, you know, that's something, though, that the more I live this life and the more every day that I go forward with it is really just a deeper faith in exactly what the Buddha was saying, and to really take on this training and not to settle for anything less than the total deliverance of the mind, and really see it through to the end and just keep pushing and keep going deeper and digging deeper. And something too, you know, I always used to say to my sister when we'd talk, I'd say, oh, well, you know, some days I'm just going to go off and be a monk. That's what I'm going to do. And she's like, yeah, you'd say that all the time, and now you're doing it. And I was like, oh, yeah. Now I'm doing it. Now this is it. This is the holy life, you know. And it's not like, you know, it's easy to romanticize. And I think a lot of people come and think, oh, you know, be great. I just get to sit down, meditate all the time, and show up and go on alms round and give people Dhamma and stuff like that. But it's much, much, much more dynamic than you could ever imagine. You know, and it takes a lot of good fortune to even come to a monastery and see how bhikkhus live and how it really is. Immense amount of gratitude for that, and really everybody that came before me. You know, it's something I think of when I reflect on the Buddha's life, and just read the Angulimara Sutra, and in it he says, once he attains arahantship, he says, now I eat debt-free. And that, you know, before in his training, you know, he's always eating the debt of the Buddha's good barmi, and that, you know, the Buddha kind of laid out this path, and all the bhikkhus were studying and training under him, and it, you know, is really because of the faith in the Buddha that, you know, so much alms and support were given, and that, you know, these the bhikkhus were able to live in that way and practice in that way. You know, so I think of, you know, all the Dhamma that I've gotten from all the bhikkhus here and everybody that's come before me that's really helped, you know, move me towards more wholesome, more beneficial mind states, lifestyle, everything, you know, just working away from samsara day by day, moment by moment. And, you know, really having the fruits of the holy life unfold, because, you know, it's easy to romanticize like anything else is. You know, but I never thought waking up today at 4:30 that I'd consider that sleeping in. You know, and to wake up out of a sleeping bag on a floor and think that's fantastic, you know, and that couldn't get better than that, you know. I never thought that would be something I'd be okay with, or really just come to really enjoy and love and see the simplicity in it, you know, and then reflect, you know, this is the holy life, this is what it is, just the very simple, very, very mundane things that just can be such powerful teachers if we reflect on them. And it's a lot of good days, you know, it's something after people will see me when they haven't seen me in a while and they say, oh, now you're in white. How long have you been white? I'm like, oh, 5 years. And it really has been just a few months. Time takes on different dimensions, but it's really peaceful. You know, I'm finding a new depth in my meditation and peace now that, you know, you just... It's really incredible, and it's really beautiful and nourishing, you know. And I'd really just give as much encouragement to really seek that out and really embrace it, you know. And I think there's a lot of good reflections in the chanting that we do. And one of my favorites is, you know, it's to be experienced individually by the wise, you know, is that this path is involves a lot of individual effort. You have to really devote yourself and really be an earnest practitioner to see the results. You know, I think like Lumpur Cha would say, you know, you give up a little, you get a little, you give up a lot, you get a lot, you give it all up, you get it all. And to really take that to heart, you know, or at least I have, is to try to really examine, you know, what is it that I'm holding on to that I can let go of, you know, about this, you know, instead of trying to say, it's them, it's that, it's not me. It's everybody else. It's the world. Yep, I think the Dhamma springs run dry and dry me tonight. But that's about as much as I got to keep people. At least I don't think anybody fell asleep. So, and I didn't say anything too egregious, but. You know, I feel like I read that sutta recently where the Buddha likens, you know, the wise cowherd that sends the big strong bulls through the river first, and then, you know, all progressively weaker members of the herd to get through, and then he talks finally about the little calves, you know, being goaded along by their moms and just struggling in the water. And I feel like that. I feel like, you know, but I have some really great examples here, and it's it's really fantastic because you know, everybody's working with what they got, and everybody sees the Dhamma in a different way, and it's really beautiful to kind of to hear that, to hear little bits from everybody, and it really helps. You know, you never know when it's gonna just chime in. You know, and it's been really fantastic being here, and I have immense amount of gratitude for everybody in this community and the whole Sangha. You know, it's not just the monastics, but all the wonderful lay people and everybody I've gotten to know since I've come here. So, yeah, thank you very much.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So I've just come out of the 2-week seclusion period, which is it's an enormous treat to retreat and step back from roles and duties and responsibilities. And unfortunately, well, it was my choice. I could have chosen another fortnight period, but I had a couple of health-related things to do with hospice volunteering the first 2 days of my time. I had 3 days in San Francisco related to the chaplaincy training that I've just undertaken. And then there was the big day of Debbie's birthday, which I couldn't miss. So I kind of, you know, I got maybe 8 days out of the 14. And what I found is that, I really like that term, repatriated anthropologist, because both the hospice volunteering and the chaplaincy training and thinking about that work and being with people, the trainers who do that work, it's taken me back to, I'm kind of like a repatriated caregiver. It's taken me back to the time when my late husband was diagnosed with terminal brain cancer, and I spent 2 years caring for him. And it's 13 years ago, but I guess it takes time to move through everything that adds up to in one's life. And and kind of, I guess, now looking at it more in a framework of the Dhamma and somehow in there's investigation of the khandhas and faith, and they all kind of come together. Because when I think I used to see faith as kind of like more devotion, and we do, you know, we chant the qualities of the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. But now I see faith much more as confidence, conviction, or trust. What do I trust? What do I have confidence in the Dharma? And when I reflected on the caregiving and the grief periods, actually, what gave me a lot of faith, a lot of confidence, was extraordinarily painful. It kind of crashed into the heart space, really. And it's everything that we chant in, you know, the truth about old age, sickness and death, the suffering, sorrow, pain, lamentation and grief, not getting what one wants. Separation, all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. And I can remember before the tumor was detected, I can remember these times where he would behave in ways that were very, very unlike him. Maybe say things that were a little cutting, cynical, sarcastic. And it was very, very difficult because after living with someone for 12, 13 years, you kind of think you have them down and you have them sussed, you understand that, you know, and usually his manner was kind and caring and thoughtful and sensitive. So what I can look back now and say is that that pain was a pain that also had the glimmer of the true nature of things within it, because it's a pain of seeing that these khandhas, his khandhas, so khandhas, the aggregates, form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness, they're conditioned. And right then and there, without our knowing it, those khandhas were conditioned, and his behavior from that was conditioned by a rather large brain tumor that was growing in the left rear portion of his head. And I remember another time when very, very close to his death, we were in the hospice. He went into the hospice, a location, not the hospice training that I'm doing is going into people's houses. But we actually lived in a hospice for about 6 weeks. And probably about 2 weeks before he died, I remember he said, "Why can't we go home? Why can't we be at home?" And I tried in many ways to explain to him, but he was getting very frustrated because he couldn't understand. He didn't anymore have the ability to understand what I was saying. He was reverting in his kind of perceptive qualities, you know, reverting. So the very simple things were hard for him to understand. And again, it's incredibly painful. But this is something that so many people experience. Older people, Alzheimer's. I know people who have cared for their partners, and it's like the person is still there in front of you in the physical form, so the form is there. But the perception and the feeling tone and the behavior, and it's all not as it was. And so when the Buddha is talking about the truth of suffering, I really feel like that's what got me a lot of faith, really, by going through that. And yes, this is incredibly painful. Everyone goes through this personally. It's about as close as you can get to going through the death process yourself, really, I think, caring for a long length of time with someone who's dying. And then between us, we had 4 children, so navigating that space with, they were 18 to 27, but still it's very, very hard to go through that. But it is, as the Buddha said, it's a lot of suffering, and all the time I think I expected through that caretaking that I would make the choice to go forth, so it was the Dhamma was with me at that time, fortunately. But I think that that faith, that my idea of faith was more that sometime, you know, the devas would come kind of floating down and it would all be sort of wonderfully beautiful. It's actually very, very different to that. It's for me finding step by step through this life, which it's now nearly 4 years here, but 10 years of a sort of a very Dharma-centric life, which I came to about a year after he died. It's step by step what the Buddha's teaching, realizing it is that way. And that the opportunity that this life provides to really very closely pay attention to that which brings suffering, that which I do that creates suffering. I've I've probably been doing breakfast in the kitchen for about 3.5 years, and I've had 12 different kitchen managers. And so there are many different ways of doing the same thing. And I can remember in earlier days that I would really want to do it my way, because my way was the right way, and this was the way to do it, and this tray should look like this. And but now it's more, I mean, I hope it's more like this. A man can tell me. My imagination of how it is now, a chicken with a man later, is, can I help you? Well, how can I help you? Like, what is it that you, that is most beneficial for you? How can I do that? And I was listening to a great talk by Lumpo Pasano. He did it, the Asala Puja, maybe 8 years ago, I think. And he was mentioning 4 Pali terms, which I might be able to pull out of the hat, but chaga nusati, chaga, generosity, but very much the generosity of giving up, giving and giving up. And I'm finally starting to get this piece that when I, because I came into the Dhamma, you know, in the 80s, in the retreat model, the Mahasi retreat model, and the way that conditioned me really was that, okay, yeah, I'll be here and I'll do this stuff, but I want to get back to my kuti and do my practice and my meditation technique. And what my attraction to this particular tradition is because it's what's happening every moment. It's about what's happening every moment. You can practice every moment. And especially the service and the community aspect and living alongside people that have very, very strong Dharma aspirations and are under a very strict discipline and training. The joy of giving to that, the joy of giving up that idea of me and my kuti and my practice in a particular style and technique, but giving, just giving, giving up that idea. And then there was pati. Pati something.
Pati needs to go.
Thank you. relinquishing, abandoning, letting go. And the way that Ajahn Chah pointed to that all the time. Like, yeah, just such a huge amount that I had never heard of Ajahn Pasano until I was listening to some Dharma. That was the Ajahn Chah Memorial Weekend. I think Gil Fronsdale, maybe it was around 2002, a lot of people gathered together. And Ajahn Pasano was one of them. He didn't say much, but I remember so clearly what he said, and I enjoyed it. He said, in the world there's status and power, and in a monastery there's views and opinions, and you better believe it, he said. So now for me, like in terms of giving up, and I, one of the things I did in my retreat, and I read it a lot because I love it very much, is in the Sutta Nipata, the last 2-3 pages are Pingya's praise of the way to beyond. And one of the lines in that, he says, I've gone from the bleary half-light of opinion. Like a swan, I've reached the great lake, the bleary half-light of opinion. It's just so what opinions do. And I see it more and more and more within my own mind. And now and again, I see it in other places, in other people. So that piece. Then there's a couple of other things in the 4 that I remember. Mutti, freeing, free, give freedom, freeing up, and for me, I'm probably maybe putting this in a different perspective, but for me, in that grief, in that time, when you're just absolutely laid open, you're just so kind of cracked open, really, and exhausted. But little by little, it does bring a freedom to choose a life like this, which I couldn't have done as a married person, not in the way that I've done it. And it wasn't like I sat down and went, okay, how can I map out this Dharma life? It was just the heart, I think, really yearning for, looking for, seeking freedom to train in a holy life. And I thought about taking the robe, but for a variety of reasons I haven't done. But I can't imagine a better situation than this here, to be here in this community, which I have maybe 2 years left to be here. So I just wanted to, I have props, in case I didn't have anything to say. I wanted to share a little bit of this reading, which is so much about faith. Faith as a strength. And I've heard Lompo Pasano and also Ajahn Janako quite often recently saying that it's faith that lets go. And so a little story about this. Pingyur has gone to the Buddha along with some other teachers to ask the questions that they have. And he comes back to his teacher, a Brahmin, Bhavari, and is explaining a little bit about what happened. And I'm going to pick it up there. Because he's singing the praises of the Buddha, Bhavari, his teacher, says, "But why then don't you spend all your time, your every moment with this man, Gotama, this universe of wisdom, this world of understanding, this teacher whose Dharma is the way things are, instant, immediate, and visible all around, eroding desire without harmful side effects, and with nothing else quite like it anywhere in the world?" That's how Pingyur has explained Gotama to his teacher. "Brahman, sir," said Pingyur, "there is no moment for me, however small, that is spent away from Gotama, from this universe of wisdom, this world of understanding." And he goes on with more of the description. "You see, sir," says Pingyur, "with constant and careful vigilance, it is possible for me to see him with my mind as clearly as with my eyes, in night as well as day. And since I spend my nights revering him, there is not to my mind a single moment spent away from him. I cannot now move away from the teaching of Gotama. The powers of confidence and joy, of intellect and awareness, hold me there. Whichever way this universe of wisdom goes, it draws me with it. Physically, I cannot move like that. My body is decaying. I am old and weak. But the driving power of purposeful thought propels me with it without break. There was a time when, wreathing in the mud of the swamps, I could only drift from one stone to the next. But then I saw the Sambuddha, fully awake and free from defilement." And then the Buddha spoke. "Pingyur," he said, "other people have freed themselves by the power of confidence. You too should let that strength release you. You too will go to the further shore beyond the draw of death." "These words," says Pingyur, "are the words of a man of wisdom. As I hear them, I become more confident. This man is Sambuddha. He has opened the curtains and woken up. There is nothing barren there. His mind is clear and luminous. Everything accessible to knowledge is known to him, even the ultimate subtleties of Godhood. There are no more questions for the doubtful who come to him. The teacher has answered them all. Yes, I shall go there. I shall go beyond change, I shall go beyond formations. I shall go beyond comparison. There are no more doubts. You may consider this as mind released. So I offer this for your reflection.
So knowing that this was coming up, there were many thoughts floating around through my meditation. But I have so enjoyed hearing the other talk so far that I'm not quite sure what will formulate. And just have to trust what will come from the heart. So a lot of my practice here at Abhayagiri is more on the move. Just a lot of office things, and with a building project going on, and a lot of things. There's fewer hours in the daytime that I see my cabin typically. So when the retreat came, I was supported in this by a number of different individuals, Beth included, and Armand, and a couple of other individuals who supported me in my plan to not come down and spend most of my time up at my cabin, not even coming down for the meal. So I did have a stash of some things up at my cabin. I can do that as a layperson. And I find it really helpful to just avoid the whole, everything down here. I find it really supportive just to really be there, and I appreciate so much the opportunity to just be there through the movement of the day. It's just so very different than even if you're there every afternoon, to have the mornings, to have just whatever feels right to your schedule. Such a wonderful opportunity. And then certain aspects of that didn't quite, you know, I was trying to be simple, but then sometimes when you try to be simple, it becomes more complicated. So some things became more complicated. And then I decided, okay, for the second week, I'm just going to come down for the meal and get some food and take it back up. And that was good also. But I didn't really have a strong plan of what I was going to do with my time. And I find this, my experience is that every time I get a self-retreat, it kind of unfolds in a unique way, and no two retreats have been the same. And this retreat, for some reason, it was, I guess it was kind of stimulated because I've, in the past few months, been seeing a physiotherapist and learning that my perceptions of my body are completely off of what's really happening. And so really trying to put more awareness into how I'm holding the posture, you know, putting the shoulders back, holding the neck back, and, paying attention to the back. And I noticed in doing that, because it's not the normal posture, that there was tension. And I think that's probably pretty normal, because you're having to relearn something. So I started paying attention to the tension and really using the space of the retreat to also reflect on allowing for more ease in the body. And the retreat ended up being a lot around space and ease, space and ease. It was kind of unplanned, but felt it was very fruitful. It always takes a while when you stop, like you go on retreat and you stop everything that you've been doing, and often getting ready to go on retreat, there's even a bit more, because you have to try to get things in a place so you can really put them down. So that's kind of how I entered the retreat, was trying to get things done so I could put them down. But this was really effective, and then I experienced a lot of spaciousness, and in that spaciousness and that paying attention to tension and ease, really heart opening, a lot of joy, a lot of space in the heart, a lot of gratitude. Gratitude's something that has been a large part of my practice from day one, from the first retreat that I took. And I allow myself to read a little bit. And one of the things that I've been wanting to read and haven't had the time is this year, His Holiness the Dalai Lama celebrated his 80th birthday. And so Shambhala-san did a commemorative issue just solely on His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And I've always found the Dalai Lama incredibly inspiring, a very incredibly inspiring being, for what he's had to face in his life. And there were many things in what I read that also provided a lot of reflection for me. One thing that I thought was, I didn't know this, that when he was younger, of course, he was discovered when he was about two as the Dalai Lama, and so they start training him when he's very young, 3, 4, I think they started training him, and he was really resistant. He really didn't like it. He wanted to be out playing with the other kids, and it wasn't until they decided that the pressure from China was starting to mount and that it was time for him to take on the responsibilities as the political leader. I think he was about 15, and that's when he realized he really needed to turn to the teachings that he was getting. And I'm maybe missing some things, but that's my recollection, which I turned 60 this year, so my memory's not very good. but that's very inspiring, because sometimes I think we can be really hard on ourselves. We get frustrated. We maybe, our spirit kind of flattens out. And but we're in a situation where if we're willing to really face the different things that come our way, the Dhamma's there when we need it. And in the situation that we've all put ourselves in, where we're living either in or within reach of a community that's devoted their life to this, then we have a lot of inspiration, encouragement to draw from. So that reflection came up. And then I read, and this was, I think, just a part of the heart really being open. I read one talk, and the person said he wasn't Buddhist, but he, can't remember his name, but he had, he was writing a book, on one of the books about the story of the Tibetans and their exile from Tibet. And he said he wanted to go to Lhasa because he needed to feel, he needed to really be there to get a feel for it, of what he was writing about, some of what he was writing about. And his description of his experience and how he was so moved by what he saw in the depth of, and it was devotion, of these people, these Tibetan people who have been through some horrendous experiences in their lives. His description was so, he was explaining what happened, what I experienced, and his words were extremely identical to what I experienced, and I just found myself weeping with gratitude that, because that's actually the first thing that I saw and felt that made me curious about what Buddhism had to teach, and it was witnessing this devotion, and I connected with it somehow very deeply, but I didn't really know what that was. It just really drew me. And then, of course, I was fortunate that timing happened to be going to Thailand before heading back to the West, and in that 2-week period, there was a 10-day retreat being offered, and it was Ajahn Buddhadasa. It was his monks And the rest is history. It's just one thing led to another. And I found the Thai forest tradition and the Ajahn Chah lineage. And yeah, just a lot of gratitude. Gratitude's another thing that brings up joy. And then in joy, there's the possibility of gratitude and joy, the possibility of settling with that. And that's what I found in this retreat, is an opportunity to just experience the spaciousness, experience the attention to easefulness, and experiencing, not every meditation by any means, but experiencing meditations where that just allowed for a really calm settling of the energies in the body and the mind. And of course, I have been on enough retreats to know that retreats end. And sometimes what you've experienced in a retreat, and you're so clear, and then within a very short period of time, it's a very distant memory. So just working with that, that feeling of trying to bring that sense of recollection of spaciousness and ease into everything as much as possible. And just, you know, even remembering to focus in and notice, where are the shoulders? Are they at my ears, or can I breathe and find a sense of ease in that? So that's just a work in progress again, continually. But the encouragement of that 2 weeks of really being able to experience that, to work with that, to have the support of other people, to know that there's a community out there. Maybe I don't see them, but I feel them. It's sharing aspirations, many, many things that we are fortunate and blessed enough to have in our lives here. Just encouragement that really supported that. And I guess the furthest I've gone from that point was the day of the container delivery, when the truck was stuck in the ditch and I noticed there was no ease and there was no spaciousness, and I felt an angst I hadn't felt in a long time. But, you know, I was aware of it, and it was okay. And it didn't last. So, just that reminder that we can bring that space and that ease into our lives as we function in relationship to others. And it may seem like such a small and obvious thing, but if you really focus into your body, tap into it throughout a day, how much ease is there really going on there in the midst of what you're doing? So for me, it was a very strong reflection, and it was maybe that's a sign of aging too, is you just kind of lighten up a little bit. So I have a lot of gratitude. That's all.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namasami. I like Anakalaka Amon's talk. But I don't think I can do it like that. Even my mind could think of that, but I just don't have the skill to say it out to everyone. So different, everybody is different. And finally, it's helpful is just pay attention to the body. That just that it will keep cut off a lot of dukkha. Just like every time this year, my just feel how do you say? The mind is not at ease, because I had to give a talk. And then I just try to go to the body, and then that will keep my mind peace for a while. If I think about it, then it will more dukkha coming. Just tell a story about myself. When I was, I don't know how old, but I think just a little kid, still learning, maybe not too old, 5, 6 years old maybe. And one time, my cousin, we have a pond, quite a big pond in front of our village. And then one day, my cousin on the other side of the pond, and then I don't know where he's going, and I call, yell out, where are you going? But the word got somehow it's not correct, and then everybody laughed at me from that time on, and then I'm really careful of my speech. I think that's the cause how I feel. Because I don't want people laugh at you. You know? The feeling is not really good. So that feeling still with me all this year, you know, 30 some years, still free of this feeling. And one of I don't know who from who one of the surveys people what's the biggest fear of the people, one of the first one is public talk.
Yes.
So there's I know that's true for me. But maybe not for a month. But that's not really important if you can speak or not. But, you know, part is very simple. The Four Noble Truth, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, that's just the first one is enough to peace, for the peace of the mind. Just keep pay attention to the body. So we have a lot of mudita for the senior monk. They don't have to give a talk. And Karuna for myself. And mudita also for everyone here. And upekkha for everyone too.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So lately, I guess I've just been reflecting on why perhaps up until recently results hadn't been coming as I might have hoped they would. And I realized that it was because perhaps I wasn't really following as strictly as I should the teachings that the Krupa Ajahns have handed down to us. So as I put forth more effort in doing things that they suggest, like eating little, sleeping little, speaking little, and just in general following the kolats that they themselves have always followed, results have followed in line with that, as I had hoped. So perhaps that's something worth reflecting on for yourselves as well.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So recently, a lot of my reflection has been about the unreliable nature of the mind, and it's good to put into practice in the immediate moment. And I often find one of the reactions that my mind stirs up in my mind is, okay, well then we'll, oh, what is reliable? And then it starts looking around. And there's not much. There's not much that kind of shows itself to be dependable and reliable. And you know, the body can be somewhat consistent, but in the short term, but you know, it's not reliable. And then it's just interesting just to keep reflecting on the different aspects of what we call a person, the individual. And just asking if it's reliable or not, and I don't know, for me recently that's been, hasn't been really frightening, hasn't been instigating panic or fear, but more of just, oh yeah, yeah, it's just another thing that I can't rely on. And I do find that just the way my mind works is that the conditions that I've created in my life, that have created my preferences, I think I subconsciously think that those preferences are reliable, and my attention keeps going to them. My attention keeps kind of vying for them as what needs to be done, or what is more accurate. There's a lot of facades that are created of reliability in the mind, and then you project that outwards, and it's a little bit of a hall of mirrors, because you keep looking back and looking back, wanting to check for consistency, dependability, reliability. You want to have practices that you know you have reliable results, So you're actually projecting something onto the Dhamma which might not be there. I guess those are some thoughts I have and don't have. For some reason, it brings some lightness to my practice now, but speaking it out loud, I'm like, oh, this is heavy. But for me, recently, there's something, it eases the pressure when you don't expect something to be reliable. It eases the demand. So you can just let it be unreliable.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So, practice for some quite a long time has really mostly been around movement of the mind and why it chooses to move the way it does, and with trying to see, you know, reasons, the causes, and then bring cessation to that, have it, you know, be less. And it, for a long time, this has been one component of this, is reflecting on something that for long, you know, early days really gave me a lot of trouble, but I'm really starting to get a good feel for it, and that's the concept of name and form. In the dependently arisen things of Paticca-samuppada expositions, there's often talked about consciousness arising with name and form, and dependent upon name and form, and name and form being dependent upon consciousness. And Sariputta has an absolutely brilliant simile of these two being bundles of reeds that support each other, and that if one is to pull out consciousness, name and form would collapse, and if one pulls out name and form, consciousness would collapse. And that sounds quite wonderful, but the question is, how does one do that? And that's something that doesn't seem very apparent, but actually the Buddha gives us all the tools to do that. And I think, you know, hopefully we can get to that point. So when we're talking about name and form, Sariputta, he basically defines this for us quite succinctly. Vedana, Chetana, Sanya, Paso, Manisikaro, this is the name component. So that's feeling, perceptions, intention, contact, and attention. This is what gives us a name. And then form is four great primaries, and form dependent upon the four great primaries. And what's apparent right from the get-go is when we're looking at objects and consciousness arising with it, is that when you have that description, there's really nothing out there about object. It's entirely internal, mental putting together. And so if you look at the first thing, feeling in
The way in the Samyutta of the Samyutta Nikaya, there's one sutta, basically there's 108 ways the Buddha describes feeling. I'm a former Goenka practitioner, and, you know, there's lots of different ways to describe how feeling is involved in something. And I personally think that my experience is weight in this context really is a lot of about like kind of the formulating of experience, and really the feeling that arises from the sense doors themselves. And this gives, you know, leads into sanya. But overall, with objects external to us, there is this feeling that is kind of the feeling tone that becomes a part of name and form. In sanya, that's fairly straightforward. We don't probably won't spend a lot of time talking about that. That's the perception of colors and shapes and or sounds, textures. Probably one of the trickiest ones to understand is chetana, intention, how that frames what objects are in our world. One of the kind of I think of an experience I had here at the monastery early on. I was out in the forest with a fellow monastic, and we had just cut down a small pine tree, and I was cutting up for, you know, he's giving me instruction on what needed to be cut, and we take this pine tree down, and I chop it up into all these little pieces, about 12 inches long, and when it fell down, it knocked down a sign at the end of the road, said, end, you know, end of the road. And we're kind of cleaning up, and he goes, we're gonna need to go get a mallet and put this sign back. And it occurred to me, well, we've got about a dozen mallets right here. And he's like, well, what are you talking about? So I picked up a small log and asked him to hold it and started pounding on this stake, and it was, that one's too light, get a heavier one, hit it again, and drove that sign back into the ground. And in that moment, that was a mallet. That's chetana. It's a function, it's a purpose, it's an intention. And now, it's not the ideal mallet. It doesn't have a hand, you know, handle that fits us, but it has mass and it performs a function. So that's one way of thinking of chetana. Chetana also, though, can be the environment something is in. I often think of, like, I think about this one object quite often, vases and glasses and pitchers. They, you know, fundamentally, they're all just cylinders that hold a liquid. But where they are, and all of a sudden they have a new name. We have pitchers that look like beer pitchers, right, that we drink from the junior monastics. And if I were to stick a bunch of flowers in one of those pitchers and put it up on that shrine, I mean, functionally, it's the same, but I'm pretty confident that name and form would impinge upon people that would be like, no, you can't do that. That's a pitcher. Why isn't it a vase? Just because we conceive of it as an object based upon certain little features, certain little looks. And so as we are children, you know, a lot of this stuff conditionally derived, and that is contact and attention. Basically, we have to play with things, and we develop our own set of conditions around objects and whatnot. And the real criminal in this experience, the real problem is attention. We only spend cursory amount of attention on objects, and therefore we develop this concept of ganasanya, which is a perception of the compact, perception that this object is something that has an intrinsic nature, as opposed to the fact that we basically just constructed it with experience. And then we become enslaved to that feeling that it evokes. And basically then, probably best for me to talk a little bit about the consciousness aspect of it is, we often have, I think, a difficulty in understanding what consciousness is, and it's actually, I think, fairly simple when you really investigate it, because we often get trapped in the objects themselves. Whereas if you look at, for example, a simple modern simile for consciousness, in Western science, they would often maybe say that consciousness is what we would refer to in Buddhist terminology as the sense door. So we would say, I'm consciousness is all these things that I see. But when the Buddha is talking about consciousness, it's more a discriminating factor in the field. So that we have this field of pixels that is the visual field. And consciousness is that which just discriminates some of those pixels, and name and form is lifting up that as something. So, and the kind of craziness of it is that when you really look at it, the result of it, why this causes dukkha, is not only is this, it's a duality that's created, but it's the fact that that object, we're not experiencing usually that object at all. That idea, that thing, all we are is relating to, consciousness is just reflecting entirely on all that past stuff. It's the vedana that was associated with it in the past. And really right now, we're not living in the moment. We're just living with all of those memories, even though we're not really conscious of it. They form this concept, this name and form that we become hooked by. But that same kind of problem, the attention, the Buddha, this is where he gives us the means to escape from this delusion we create and knock down one of those bundles. And it's really name and form. He often is training us to knock down the self component, the subject component, and this is what the Satipatthana practices are really doing. We're looking at all this experience with yoniso manasikara instead of just the manasikara. Instead of just attending to them briefly, delighting in it, clinging to it, wanting it, chasing that feeling, we're looking at it, either ourselves, the experience that it's bringing to us, and we're attending to it in a much more radically intensive way and challenging these phenomena of the body, of the mental components, the dhammas. We're looking at all these names and forms that we play with in a much more fundamental nature. And this is what 32 parts practice is, the four elements practice. You know, when it comes to name and form, that's the form part. This is really one of the real hooks is the form Sariputta describes that as, you know, the four great elements and form dependent on the four great elements. And so we're often just captured by that visual. But, you know, when we're looking at the 32 parts, the 32 parts in a way is just arbitrary. And any of those 32 parts, the hair of the head, the kidneys, the hearts, nails, teeth, skin, any part of those are just another name and form. But we're attending to them in such a way that we are basically tearing down the constructing of name and form and going, man, there's no concept that really can withstand the scrutiny. If I look at the body in terms of elements, this is the nature of all things. This is just develops dispassion towards conceiving of anything, of having any essence, and really seeing the sunyata of all of this experience, the emptiness of all of this experience. And then the mind just doesn't really want to go. It doesn't want to go to any of them. And it'll just stay with the breath. Let's just stay with the body. And this is this is peace, this is happiness, this is bliss. I think for me, one of the most beautiful and powerful expositions on this is in the Udana, the Bahiya Sutta. Bahiya conceives of himself as being an arhant, and he's probably quite an accomplished practitioner. The bark aesthetic, he's living in the forest, he's a very serious forest practitioner, and he thinks that he's an arhant. And a former relative of his has passed away and becomes a devata and comes to him and says, no, Bahiya, you're not an arhant, but there is an arhant, and that's the Buddha Gotama. And so Bahiya sets out to find the Buddha. He comes across the Buddha while the Buddha's on his way to alms, and it's kind of a peculiar thing. Bahiya is like, I think I get this sense of like kind of exasperation, like I need to know the truth. Well, and two times the Buddha puts him off, and the third time the Buddha just lays it down. He says, Bahiya, thus you should train yourself. In the seen, there is only the seen. In the heard, there is only the heard. In the sensed, there is only the sensed. In the cognized, there is only the cognized. And when you have trained yourself thus, and you see and only the seen, and you hear only the heard, and in the sensed, there is only the sensed, and in the cognized, there is only the cognized, then you won't be by it, you won't be in it, and you won't be anywhere in between. And that is the cessation of suffering. And there's no objects. You won't be by this object. You won't be by this microphone, this picture, this whatever this thing is. And you won't be in it, in that experience. I am not seeing that object. And then, then you don't relate to it as something that I need or I want, or it's just a phenomenon that's there, and it's going to go away. And this was enough to bring Bahiya, because he was quite ripe, to the fruition of arhantship. He became an arhant just like that. And the Buddha continued on his alms round, and then unfortunately, I think, maybe Bahiya had a sense of foreboding with his I need to know, because Bahiya shortly thereafter was killed. And on returning from alms round, the bhikkhus informed the Buddha of Bahiya's passing, and he tells the bhikkhus that, he should be taken care of as they would take care of their own. And after they've given him his proper rites, they return to the Buddha and ask the Buddha, what's the rebirth of Bahiya? What is his state? What's become of him? And he says, Bahiya has attained parinibbana. He's gone. He's done with the work. And being that it's an Udana, he gives an exalted utterance. If you're not familiar with the Udana, they all involve utterances of joy, of insight. And the Buddha's utterance is where water, earth, fire, and air find no footing. There the stars do not glimmer, the sun does not shine, the moon does not glow, but there is no darkness. For a Brahmin who trains thus and who knows and has seen this wisdom for himself, for him there is no form or formlessness, and there is no pleasure and pain. And this is sunyata. This is the cessation of name and form, bringing about the cessation of suffering, the very beginning. Earth, fire, water, air find no footing. This is name and form. This is the form component. When he only saw this, what is seen. He didn't conceive of an object. He didn't conceive any longer of himself in the object. And that brings about the end of form and formlessness. I mean, one of the problems that all the other aesthetics of the time had was they thought the escape from form was these sublime states of formless. But that implies a duality. When one goes to formless, you still think there's a form, and therefore you're eventually going to swing back to the form. But the Buddha teaches us with radical attention to attend to the origin of all these phenomena, and then you see that there's nothing there but dukkha. So, just a few words.